How many of you in here, just by show of hands, quick straw poll, are procrastinators? You wait till the last possible minute to get things done. Yep. How many of you have found that works pretty well for you in life? Yeah, I don't know. See, I made it through high school that way, but in college, it didn't work very well, and I had to learn. And especially seminary, it really didn't work there. But I've had to slowly learn to plan ahead a little bit for some of these things. Now, next question, springboard off of that one. How many of you find that you tend to have a lot of projects unfinished sitting around? Oh, yeah, yeah. How many of you are really good at coming up with ideas for new projects and finishing them? Well, Paul started a new project several weeks ago when we got into Acts chapter 14. He set off on this journey to evangelize the at least part of the Roman world. And as we looked at all of these things, we saw him cross over to Cyprus and Paphos, and then he went up to Perga. When he went into Perga, he's entering kind of a new domain. This is very, very Roman territory. And he went through Perga, and he went through Antioch, and he went to Iconium and Lystra, and we kind of left him off at Derbe, but starting to return. All of these areas, he's planting new churches. And as we looked at the last few verses of Acts chapter 14, we saw that he's not just going in and preaching the gospel and leaving. He's making sure there's an established church there, an organized group of believers that can carry on the work. Because Paul's goal was never to plant the gospel and try to reach everybody himself. Shouldn't be our goal either, by the way. Can you possibly reach everybody that needs to be reached? No. And that's not God's design. God's design is he's going to use each individual according to his own purposes. And so you're going to reach some people that this person can't reach. And Gary's going to reach some people that Joe can't reach. And Joe's going to reach people that Tom can't reach. And putting us the whole church together, God accomplishes his purpose of building the church. That's the beauty of it. And so Paul goes through each of these cities. He endures different levels of persecution in each of them. And then it says, as he's going back through the way, this is verse 23 of chapter 14, he's appointing elders for them in every church with prayer and fasting and committing them to the Lord in whom they had believed. And so as he's going back through these cities, he is establishing this pattern that we still follow today of local church. Now, why is the local church such a big deal? When Christ said, "I will build my church," was he talking about the local church specifically? No, he was talking about the universal church. We understand the theological concept that the church is every believer throughout the church age. Every person who's put their faith in Christ from Pentecost until the rapture happens. That's the church. There's a distinction between the church and Israel. There's going to be a distinction between the church and believers during the tribulation period. There's even going to be a distinction between the church and the people that are faithful during the millennial kingdom. Church is unique in God's program. Paul is establishing that church by going out and preaching the gospel in all these different places. So when Christ said, "I will build my church," he means the whole thing. So what's so important about the local church? The local church is supposed to be a microcosm. It's supposed to be a local example of the universal church. And so in every way that the universal church functions, we're supposed to be doing that here at Mendota Bible as a local church. And so we're supposed to be teaching one another in the Word. We're supposed to be encouraging one another. We're supposed to be rebuking one another. We're supposed to be evangelizing the area around us. And so in that way, just like God works through individuals to accomplish his purposes, God works through individual churches to accomplish his purposes. And so Paul is establishing that pattern, and it's something that's going to continue because many of the books of the New Testament are written to local churches. In fact, something interesting is going on here. As we've been reading through these narratives, we've encountered a lot of locale names that are not very familiar to us. You know, we don't have too many towns around here called Pisidian Antioch and Iconium. We choose names like Peru and Ohio and Mendota and that one that I can never remember how to pronounce that's French but isn't really French. Marseilles. See, I get it wrong. every time. Marseilles. But it's French. You're not supposed to pronounce the L. Right? Except if you're here. Then we, okay. Because it's an American version of French, right? Who cares how the French pronounce things in France? But we are running into some names in the text that are not real familiar to us. And so just to help piece some of those things together, we have read about an area called Pamphylia. In fact, in verse 24, that's the first thing that is mentioned. He passes through Pisidia and came to Pamphylia. So looking at the map up here on the screen, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, and Antioch, those are all in a broader region called Pisidia, which is why it's called Pisidian Antioch, as opposed to the Syrian Antioch, where they started this whole thing. That's a region called Pisidia. Now, Perga, which is down there on the coastline, that's in a different region called Pamphylia. Try to imagine this as something like our county distinctions. We live in, well, you know, right now we're not even in Mendota, are we? We call it Mendota Bible Church, but we don't live in Mendota. This church isn't within the city limits. We're outside of the city limits. So we talk about Mendota Bible Church, but imagine if you were from another country, how confusing that would be. Because you'd say, where do you go to church? Oh, I go to church in Mendota. And they would look at a map and say, but wait a second, you're not within the limits of Mendota. Well, yeah, but we call it Mendota. Okay, we're not Mendota. That's okay. We're close enough, we call us Mendota. We're actually in Troy Grove Township, right? Oh, but we're also in LaSalle County. Oh, we're also in the state of Illinois. And to us as Americans, this all makes sense because we can kind of picture the breakdown in our heads. Same thing is going on here. So some of these cities are in the county Pamphylia. Pergus is in Pamphylia. All the other cities are in sort of like a county called Pisidia. All of those are in a broader region called Galatia. Now that ought to start striking a little bit of a chord of memory with you. Because what does Paul write later on? A letter to the Galatian churches. Guess who he's writing to? He's writing to the churches in Galatia, which would be Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe. These cities in which Paul founded a church. Excuse me. Later on, he's going to have to write to them because they are starting to depart from the gospel that he taught them. In fact, it's probably not too far past this event. There's a lot of debate about whether or not the book of Galatians was written before the Jerusalem Council or after it. And the Jerusalem Council takes place in the very next chapter. We're going to be looking at it soon. So, Paul is going through here. He's establishing these local churches. Excuse me. Establishing these local churches, appointing elders in them with prayer and fasting, because that's a very important decision as you appoint the leadership of the church. But then in verse 24, where we pick up again, it says, they passed through Pisidia, came to Pamphylia, and when they had spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. Now, Attalia is a little town. It's not shown on our map here because it would fall under the circle that is Perga. Perga was inland, just a couple of miles. Attalia is the coast port town. So if you want to catch a ship, you can't do it in Perga. You can't get there from here, right? You have to go down to Attalia. And so they went down to Attalia, and they got on a boat, and it says they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work that had been fulfilled. And so we find them after returning through those areas, they go back to Antioch. And the circle has been completed. They have returned to the place from whence they started. And what I really want to focus on is just a couple of the phrases that are used here as they finish up this work. Because it's really interesting what the way that Luke writes this for us. Now, Paul and Barnabas have just completed a nearly 1,200-mile trek. If you add up, and that's as the crow flies. We can understand that Paul and Barnabas don't have wings. So the routes they took probably added a few miles. So we're looking at somewhere around 1,300, 1,400 miles. And they didn't have cars, and they didn't have mass transportation. The quickest thing they took would have been a boat, but most of the rest of it they had to walk. And this is the work of the gospel that Paul's talking about here. And so they traveled these 1,200 miles. We're not sure how long it took them. Probably a year or maybe a little more, maybe 2 years. We're reasonably sure of a couple of dates in the book of Acts, and one is the famine in which Paul and Barnabas take an offering to Jerusalem, and that happened in 44, 45. And we're reasonably sure that the Jerusalem Council takes place in like 49 or 50. So that gives us a narrow window in which this event could take place. So probably they begin the trip in 48, and maybe they finish it up in 49, maybe in 50. But notice what Luke writes for us about this trip. After they've finished it all up, they head back to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work that they had fulfilled. Now, the grace of God here, or the word appointed, is translated several different ways throughout the Bible. You might be surprised that many times it's translated betrayed. This is the same word that's used when Judas betrays Jesus into the hands of the Jews. It's often used of when Peter was delivered to the guardhouse just a few chapters ago when he was put in prison. But it is that idea of a transfer of power and authority. It's a transfer from one realm of authority to another. So if I am betraying you, it's of course in a very negative sense. But that betraying is not in the word itself, it's in the broader context. The basic idea of the word is that transfer of power. But what are they transferring here? They're commending them to the grace of God. The church there at Antioch, and that's not saying that the church is a place that's devoid of grace, but it's that they really are acknowledging that the only way that Paul and Barnabas are going to accomplish this work is if they are in the realm of the grace of God. It's only if they are under the power and influence and authority of God's grace. And the focus that Luke puts on this phrasing is not so much on the delivering aspect, but on the realm into which they've been delivered. So I can talk about, I maybe take my kids swimming and teach them how to swim and focus on the idea of teaching them how to swim, or I can focus on the idea that I picked Timmy up and threw him into the water. And now there's the permanent result of that, which is he's wet. Well, it's not too permanent. I mean, he'll dry off at some point. And so that's where Luke is at here. He's focusing on the wetness. He's focusing on where they're at now. They were commended to the grace of God. This idea of grace, we sang about it today. We've talked about it a little bit as Paul was encouraging Timothy to be strengthened in the grace of God. And it's something that the early church completely recognized, that this gospel is a gospel of grace, meaning that we're accepted by grace, but also meaning that any work that we are given to do can only be accomplished by grace. It's not that, and this is a big part of what Galatians has to attack, it's not that God makes up for what I lack. I think I've mentioned this before, but how many of you have heard the song, "I've Got You Covered, I'll Make Up the Difference"? Guy's standing in line behind a little boy, I think, who's trying to buy something. Little boy doesn't have enough money, and so the chorus of the song is, "I got you covered," and the guy pays the rest of the money that the little boy didn't have. Not the same as Christmas shoes, by the way. But in that song, the chorus is supposed to be a very stirring chorus, and it says, "I got you covered, I'll make up the difference." And it's supposed to just make us think, oh, that's just a fantastic, gracious, loving act to do. Well, it would be from one person to another, but I want you to apply your theological thinking to that. How much do I contribute to my salvation? Nothing. I'm in the problem I'm in because of me. When I try to contribute to my salvation, all I do is dig the hole deeper. I don't make any progress, and so it's not that I can contribute 1 or 2 or 3 points to it, and God has to contribute 100,000. It's that I contribute nothing. I contribute less than nothing, and God's grace has to reach down and grab me and pull me out of the pit in which I've dug myself and lift me up. And that's grace. And so Paul, in here talking about the grace of God, he was encouraging the churches to continue in the grace of God. He talked to Timothy, be strengthened by the grace of God. Throughout the whole book of Galatians, he's going to have to instruct those same churches. Look, when I was talking to you about grace, here's what I meant. Because they were turning away from grace and doing what naturally happens in the human mind. We're turning back to works. We're turning back to this idea that, hey, I got to do something. I got to be part of this somehow. And so grace is an extremely important concept throughout the entire scripture. So it's not that I do a little bit and then God's grace reaches and fills in the void for me. It's that I trust to it completely. I trust to His grace only and totally. Realizing that I've got nothing when I come to this. And not only do I have nothing when I'm talking about salvation, but I have nothing when it comes to service for Him. And this, I think, is where some of our ideas get a little more muddled, because, you know, we're in conservative Bible preaching churches. We tend to understand salvation by grace through faith, apart from works. It's part of our doctrinal statement. But then I think this idea creeps in that if I'm going to be serving God, it has to be somewhat by my own energy, right? Well, yes and no. Do I participate? Yeah. Does God use me? Yeah. But is it me? No. And so it says, we're commending you to the grace of God. You're putting them in this realm in which it says this has nothing to do with human merit. This has nothing to do with human works. Let's take a look at a couple passages that maybe will help clarify what's going on here. And these are written by Paul. So we know that this is his understanding of what's going on here. Romans 12, 6 through 8. Just turn there real quick. Romans is one of Paul's later books. But verses 6 through 8, talking about spiritual gifts. He says, having gifts that differ according to the what given to us? Grace. So where do spiritual gifts, let's back up. What are spiritual gifts for? Service, building up the church, right? So Christ and His purposes of building the church is going to use us to do it. So He picked Don because Don was so skilled at this area that Christ said, you know what, I really need Don because I need this part of my church built up. Is that the conception we're supposed to have? No. Because what is it called? A spiritual gift. Do you earn gifts? No, because as soon as you say you've earned it, it's not a gift anymore, it's a wage. So, having spiritual gifts according to the grace given to us. So that gift is given by grace. It's not given by merit. It's not looking down and saying, well, you know what, Ed would really do a good job if I give him this thing, so I'm going to give it to him. That would be merit. What is grace? It's God's favor to us. It's God's gift to us. It's God's desire to do good to us, even though we don't deserve it. That's grace. Maybe you've heard the acronym that goes along with it, God's riches at Christ's expense. So the spiritual gifts through which we build the church are given by God's grace. They are not dependent upon us. It's a shame sometimes that we apply that thinking, because even we see somebody that has an abundant spiritual gift, we usually call them gifted, or we say that person has a great deal of charisma. Do you realize we're using the same words there? We're being redundant. Charisma is the Greek word for gift. And it is based on the other Greek word charis, which means grace. So a gift is a grace given. They're the same thing. So when we talk about a spiritual gift, we're talking about an aspect of God's grace that has been given to us for a specific purpose, to build the church. And so it's not the person, it's not that that person has charisma, it's that they have been given a charisma. But we subtly turn the attention from the God who gives to the person to whom it's given. And unfortunately, we in the church are not immune from personality worship. But it is something to be aware of and guard ourselves against. So, spiritual gifts are abilities that we have to build the church, but they're given to us. They're not intrinsic. Ephesians 1:7. Jump a few pages back past Acts through Corinthians. Ephesians 1:7 says, "In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace." Forgiveness is based on grace. It's based on God's favor to us, his gift to us. It's not based on my deservedness. Aren't we glad about that? Because what would I get forgiven if it were based on my deservedness? Nothing. But God forgives us according to his grace. Ephesians 2:7 should be on the same page in most of your Bibles. It says, "So that in the coming ages he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness towards us in Christ Jesus." What are we going to be doing throughout eternity, discovering how amazing God's grace has been? Ephesians 3:7-8, Paul says he was made an apostle to the Gentiles by God's grace. Hebrews 4:14-16, we're encouraged to seek out God's grace through Jesus Christ to help us when we're weak in resisting temptation. That call to come before the throne, we come boldly to a throne of grace. It's not a throne of merit. So how can I come boldly? Because it doesn't depend on me. It depends on his favor and how gracious is he? Abundantly, beyond measure. We can't account for it. Isn't that great? Your only qualification is inability. But you have to acknowledge it. Right? So, 1 Peter 4:10 says we are to be stewards of the gifts of grace. So here's where we get into the human responsibility of it. This ability to build the church is not my ability. It doesn't come from me. It's not sourced with me. It doesn't begin with me. It's not going to end with me. But yes, I'm responsible to put it to work. So I do have a part to play as long as I recognize that all of the accomplishments are not mine. All of the ability is not mine. It's his. It was a gift. And here God's grace extends even farther because he chooses in his grace to reward us for using those gifts as good stewards. Didn't start with me. It's not going to end with me. It's not about me. And yet he's going to reward me. Isn't that a good God? Well, Jude even gives us a warning here. Jude 1:4 says that some will inevitably teach that because we're forgiven by grace, that means we can do whatever we want. And this has been leveled at people that teach the doctrines of grace for many, many years. Well, if you think that you can be forgiven for anything just by believing in Jesus, then what's going to stop people from doing anything they want? The answer is the very knowledge that I'm forgiven for everything by grace leads me to say, I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to live there anymore. I want to cast off the bonds of sin because now, by God's grace, it's absolutely possible for me to live in an obedient way. Grace doesn't equal license. Grace also doesn't equal law. And that's what Paul's going to have to argue against more in the book of Galatians, is because people were coming in and saying, hey, this grace thing, that's all good, but you got to add law to it. And Paul's answer is vehement. Let them be counted as anathema if they pervert the gospel of the grace of Christ. Well, that's the ministry that Paul has been involved in all of these teachings. So going back to Acts chapter 13 or 14, where we're finishing up this chapter, Paul says that he's returning to Antioch for where they had been committed to the grace of God. So it's not just that they had been saved by grace, but here they are laboring by grace, but they're also spreading the gospel of grace. And so now they return back to Antioch, from which place they had been commended to the grace of God. But notice what he says next, for the work that they had fulfilled. And here again we get back to this idea of stewardship. The grace of God does not exclude being good stewards of the grace of God. So the grace of God, or being good stewards of the grace of God, is necessarily going to mean putting that grace into work in my life, in overcoming sin, in serving to build the church, and in spreading the knowledge of the gospel of grace. But always understanding it's not me, it's the one accomplishing the results. Well, Paul returns there, and Luke says they fulfilled the work. Well, let me ask you this question. Has the gospel gone everywhere at this point in the narrative? No. I mean, this is a pretty limited region. We're talking 1,200 miles. Well, the earth is, what, 24,000 miles around? That's a lot of land they haven't covered yet. So in what sense did they fulfill the work? Well, we've got to understand, this is not a fulfillment of the Great Commission. This is part of it. But probably what's being referenced here is that the Antioch church, along with Paul and Barnabas, when the Spirit began to move that these two men were to be sent out, they made a plan. And I'm not going to be too dogmatic about this, but if you see some evidence against that, you can tell me. But the very fact that he's talking about fulfillment of a work that was begun, I think means that they had a specific mission in mind. They had a plan that they were going to follow. And so very likely that the path they took was not some haphazard, let's flip a coin and cast lots and see which way God leads us, or let's just see what doors open up. It was a definitive plan where they said, you know what, let's plant the gospel over there in Pisidia, and we'll wrap around Cyprus and come up to Pisidia. That was the plan. And so as he gets back to Antioch, he's able to tell the church there, we've fulfilled the plan. We've done it. We've been good stewards of it. I think there's also some indication in that context that the Antioch church is the one that financed this mission. And we continue that tradition today. We finance missionaries so that they can go out. But Paul goes through all these places preaching and teaching. How did he care for himself and his team while he was there? Somebody had to finance this. And likely they were very, very frugal. Well, they probably didn't stay at the best hotels while they were traveling around. It could be that the churches supported them a little bit, but Paul tells us in some of his other epistles that he did not like to accept church help from the church at which he was ministering at the time. That was his offering to the Lord as he went about preaching the gospel, was that he did it free of charge to the church where he was. And so he returns to Antioch, and now, of course, it's time for the first church missions conference. Because look how it happens. When they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God had done with them. I think this would have been a fantastic missions conference to be at. Can you imagine the slideshows? You know? Oh, here we are in Cyprus. Yeah, that's Sergius Paulus. He's the leader of the, he's the governor of the Roman province there. And yep, that's Elymas the magician. Oh, look, here, we got a, good. Barnabas caught a picture of him when I cursed him. That's good. You know, he turned leprous. Great. Oh, here we are sailing across. Isn't that some beautiful scenery as we cross the Mediterranean over here to Perga? And here's the bazaar in Perga. We did some shopping on Monday afternoon as we took a little rest. And here we are in Antioch. Yep, that's the Jews all gathering up and shaking their fists and gnashing their teeth at us, driving us out of the city. Here's our eviction notice. Oh, there's the priest of the pagan temple at Iconium. Yeah, you see that bowl there? They were going to try and make hamburgers for everybody in our name, and we had to try to stop. I mean, just imagine the stories that they're telling people as they report to the church what's going on here. But when they arrived, they gathered the church together, and they declared all that God had done with them. And there again is that phrasing, who did it? God did it. He did it with them. He used them to accomplish it, but God did it. And they're very clear to mark it that way. God did it, and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. Well, when you talk about a door, what's usually on the other side of a door? More space, right? So, Paul, I think, even knows this is not the end of the Gentile mission. This is just the beginning. We've opened a door. The gospel's been planted in the Roman province of Galatia. Now what? That door's open. Let's go in and take it farther. They're going to here in a couple of chapters. Opened a door of faith to the Gentiles, and they remained no little time with the disciples. So, there's the one time marker that Luke gives us in the narrative. He's going to spend a pretty good deal of time here in Antioch before what comes next in chapter 15. We don't know how much time, but we know that it's some. So, they return from this missionary journey and they spend some time encouraging the saints. Is the Christian life all about evangelism? Is that the totality of what we're here to do? It's not the totality. I'm not trying to say it's a small part. It's a big part, but it's not the whole part. Part of what we do is encouraging the saints. Part of what we do is building each other up. Part of what we do is evangelizing. We have to have a rounded view of those things so that we don't get imbalanced in our view of what the Christian life is about. Is loving your wife part of your Christian life, guys? Everybody nod and say, absolutely. That's a big part of your Christian life, right? Raising children? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Leading your grandchildren? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about like washing dishes and laundry? Is that part of the Christian life? Absolutely. Okay. And so all of these things go together. Encouraging the saints is a big part of the work of the church. And so Paul and Barnabas are taking part in that. So we've come to the end of the first missionary journey. Several months at any rate, maybe 18 months of time, 1,200 miles, and they come full circle. So what can we take away as we end up chapter 14 here? Well, first of all, going back just a few verses, and I mentioned this last week as we were talking about some of the things Paul and Barnabas encountered, and that is expect that there will be difficulties. We know there will be. We all love peace and quiet. We all love when everything's going really, really well. I mean, our heart delights in that. But we have to know that there are difficulties coming. And some of those are just going to be the general difficulties of living in a sin-cursed world. Some of those are going to be the results of my foolish, sinful decisions and bearing the consequences of them. And some of them are going to be the results of resistance that other people put on me for my stance for the gospel. We're going to endure all kinds. James tells us, rejoice in those things. Whichever kind it is, rejoice at all of the diverse types of trials that you're going to fall under. Because God has a purpose for trials. He has a purpose in you, and he has a purpose in the other people that are around you while you're going through it. Paul, I guarantee you, learned some things in the trials he suffered on this journey. The church learned some things at the sufferings that Paul and Barnabas endured. And that suffering even extended to the church. So, rely on grace. Grace is not just some out there idea. God's favor is a very real thing, and it is a day-to-day supply. I think one of the other extremes we have to avoid getting our minds into are thinking that grace is like this pool of stuff that we have to tap into and channel. And that, you know, if you read your Bible today, you'll get so many points of grace. Or if you come to church this week, you'll get a few more points of grace. That's not how it works. Because grace is God's favor. Now, drawing near to him is absolutely necessary to being a beneficiary of his grace. And how do you draw near to him? Well, it's not like there's a set of rules to do it, but does Bible reading help you draw near to him? Yes, if you do it in the right attitude. Prayer, does that help you draw near to him? Absolutely, if you're not thinking of it as a work by which you merit grace. Church attendance, the same thing. So all of those things are means by which we draw near to him and learn to depend on his grace even more. When those trials come, his grace is sufficient. Depend on it. Lean on it. Seek it. Trust to grace. You know, it's by grace you were saved when you believed. It's by grace that you're going to overcome your own sin as you live out your salvation. And it's by grace that you're going to help build the church. It's not of your own merit. Encourage the saints. Tell stories of how God's grace has been effective in your life and things God's accomplished in you. We need to hear that from each other. We need to hear, well, you know what, I was in a conversation with somebody the other day and I said this and it just exploded. And boy, I really wish I hadn't said that. Yes, it's okay to tell about failures. And I understand you got to be discerning about, I'm not airing dirty laundry, but at the same time, hey, it's beneficial to me if I hear how somebody else blew it, isn't it? Be real. Don't be afraid to be real, especially here at the church. It should be that safe place. But encourage the saints. Tell about how God's at work in your life. Tell about how God has done things for you. We need to hear those things. It's encouraging to us. And be involved in the work of spreading the gospel. Look for opportunities. Paul planted local churches in the major metropolitan areas, and it was going to be then their responsibility to spread the gospel to the areas around their cities. We've been planted here for over 55 years now, somewhere around there. And our job has been to try to evangelize Mendota and the surrounding areas. And we continue in that work. When will that be done? Never. And so we've got our work cut out for us. So the lessons of the first missionary journey are those, and those are things that I think that we can take home and encourage each other with. Don't give up on the work. Like Paul encouraged Timothy, be strengthened in the grace of God. Depend on it every day. Recognize that it's grace that enables us to accomplish the mission. Our final song is going to reflect that fact as we're going to sing together a song that just tells us that, hey, look, we need to draw near. If we want to depend on grace, then we have to continually draw near to Him. And so we're going to sing this prayer, Jesus, keep me near the cross. Because that's where we find our strength, that example of Christ's obedience, even to the point of death. So let's stand together. Dan's going to come and finish us up in our final song.